Hello, I'm Steve Hallfish. Welcome to a special Voices from Sundance episode of the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. Sundance just wrapped up another exciting festival, virtually, from Park City, Utah, with indie filmmakers participating from around the world. These films usually come from interesting new voices, and we're happy to talk to one of them today. We're speaking with editor Harrison Atkins about the film Emily the Criminal. The film stars Aubrey Plaza, who's been featured in previous Sundance films, as a woman who slides uneasily into the dark world of credit card fraud and identity theft. The film was written and directed by John Patton Ford. Harrison describes himself as a holistic filmmaker, wearing numerous hats on many different productions, including directing and cinematography. But he's edited several indie features, including Lace Crater, Madeline's Madeline, and Karma Link. Harrison, I really enjoyed this movie. Thanks for joining me. This is a great little project. It must have been exciting just to get into Sundance.
Yeah, thank you. We were slaving on it to try to hit the Sundance deadline. So it felt really gratifying that our efforts were appreciated.
Awesome. Well, since you're talking about slaving away to get it to the Sundance deadline, when did you shoot? How many days, weeks? And then how long was post after that?
Generally, I think the shoot was 3 weeks, around 20, 21 days, I think. I had a pretty lean, mean, down and dirty production in LA. During that time, I was receiving shuttle drives and beginning an assembly. And I think we worked on it for 2 months and a little bit of change. Though I think between the shoot and our Sundance deadline was maybe only 6 weeks, if I recall correctly. I might be wrong, but something really fast like that. It felt crazy. By the time the shoot was finished, most of an assembly existed. I think we had a full, pretty solid assembly, maybe a week or so after the shoot.
That's great. And then the rest of the time was director's cut or director's cut plus?
Well, I'm vaguely aware that editors tend to organize their workflows like that, but I don't really have much of a frame of reference for thinking of it that way. I guess possibly because a lot of the independent film world that I come out of is looser. But generally, the director and I were trading off on how we thought about our cuts. After my first assembly, the director and I did a cut together in the same room. And then I went off and did a cut alone, and then we did one together, and then switching off like that.
That's one of the reasons why I love doing these interviews, is because everybody's different, and every workflow and every movie's different. So I think people appreciate hearing, oh, okay, I don't have to worry about doing things like they taught me in film school, or like I heard happened on some Star Wars epic that was $200 million.
You know? Right. It just felt more vaguely like we were just in the trenches and just trying to solve the movie. I think our workflow didn't really have much of a traditional structure. It was mostly just a war.
Just a war. I love that. We've talked before, and you described yourself as a holistic filmmaker, and I've seen your credits include cinematographer and credit design and director. How do you see your role as editor in that kind of holistic filmmaking group that you've set yourself in?
Well, I guess the way I started to get editing gigs and have editor credits on movies was that I was just my own filmmaker directing stuff. I directed some shorts, which I also edited, and then a feature, which I also edited. And I think based on that feature, I started being approached about editing other people's films. So it became almost a money thing for me, where I was like, oh, editing is a way that I can be creative and be useful and have, you know, relatively nourishing work on other people's films and make money doing it. I consider my main quest as a filmmaker to be more holistic, where I'm writing my own scripts and directing my own projects, and I'm just interested broadly in cinematic form and language, and that's really just what gets me out of bed in the morning. So it feels like to be working as an editor kind of scratches that itch. Perhaps if films that I am directing would have a different sensibility or different thematic or formal concerns, but as a way to make a living and still feel like I am interacting with the fabric and the language of cinema. It's a pretty nourishing day job, is the way that I think about it.
As you go on to your next directing and cinematography jobs, what do you think you'll take from the things that you learned editing into those separate tasks?
That's a good question. And that has been maybe one of my prevailing compasses for how I've thought about this, the editor detours that I've been taking. And it's true that I think I learned something from every project that I've worked on as an editor. I think it's different for each film that I've worked on. Each director is different, and the way that they approach the material of their script is different. So this film, for example, there was a lot of coverage, which was both luxurious and intimidating. And I had never edited a film that had so much coverage. So it felt like each scene could be a Pandora's box where there were so many possible permutations that having the rigor to find the best one became like fighting a dragon or something like that. I think I learned a lot from having all of that latitude in the edit. I think in the end, the movie feels pretty pressure cooked or something into a pretty sharp version of itself. There are sequences in the movie that don't feel like the movie has a lot of coverage, perhaps because we were aiming for a language that felt so intentional that you don't feel the application of all that coverage in the way that the language of the movie unfolds. I guess it's tough to distill it down into like a granular thing that I'm taking from it, quote unquote, but I feel like I learned a lot about how to navigate having a surplus of possibility on this film.
Totally get it. I started largely as an editor and have been asked to direct things because of it. And it's one of those things that I feel pretty confident because of my editing skills, because I know what I want in the edit room. I know what's a waste and I know what's super valuable when you're trying to build a story. So
I used to work with this director, Joe Swanberg. I worked with him on a bunch of projects. And if you're not familiar with him, he's a director and I think he's in his late 30s. And he's made a lot of movies. He's made like 20 features because they're like improv movies mostly, where he'll have the gist of what he's trying to do with the actors. And then all the dialogue will be improvised on set. And often in the process, they'll be like discovering a lot of the narrative ideas of the film and being like, oh, we need a scene where this happens, or we need a scene where this happens. So the iteration of the plot of the movie happens over the course of the production of the movie. And so I worked with him for a while, first as an assistant editor when I first got out of college, and then later on as an editor and eventually helping to produce his Netflix series, which is called Easy. And I learned so much from that process, I think, in tandem with Joe, because if anything, the way that his sensibility as a director evolved was that he became more adept at understanding what kernels of information or meaning to include out of a given, let's say, a 20-minute take of improvisation. So it's like when you have that skill as a director and editor, which he had, you can watch actors improvise for a long take and know the 30 seconds to 1 minute long piece that has the particular umami that carries the narrative forward and that feels the most sublime. I really think that's a muscle.
And how did you meet the director that you worked on Emily the Criminal on?
So that director, John Patton Ford, I just got the script from my agent. I'm not totally sure whether he reached out to my agent or what happened. I read the script and really dug it. The script really feels like the movie. It's really tense and fast and slick. So we met up and I knew that Aubrey was attached to the movie, and I've worked with Aubrey before and have been friends with Aubrey for a while, but I think John didn't even know that. So when I met John and I was like, oh, I know Aubrey, we're friends and I've worked with her, he was like, oh, wow. And then it just kind of flowed really easily into me working on the project after that.
That's awesome. I wasn't expecting to ask this question, but since you brought up the point of agents, it's one of those things that I've talked to a bunch of editors about. Oftentimes people say, the agent doesn't even get me the job, but there's still a value to the agent. Can you talk to me about the value of an agent is to you?
Well, in an editing context, through my agent, I receive scripts. Often before a movie is shot, they'll be trying to attach an editor, especially because I think it's become more common these days to have an editor editing throughout production. These days, it seems like there's a steady flow of scripts that come my way. And so when I'm between projects and even like finishing up a gig and maybe thinking about what to work on next, my agent will be sending me stuff that's kind of circulating or that I might be in the mix to be considered for. And then usually if I read a script and feel like it's a good fit for me, then through my agent, some kind of meeting will be set up between me and the director. It's this like facilitation project for how I get on board in movies.
You used Premiere on this, correct? Premiere Pro?
Yeah, we used Premiere.
Did you use Productions? Do you know what those are? Or did you just use a standard bin and production structure?
It was a pretty standard structure. I'm a little familiar with the idea of Productions, but I've never used them on a project before. If I understand correctly, it's kind of like an Avid workflow sort of where you can sync between different computers, right?
It also helps you to break the project up because I've cut entire features in Premiere. And in the old days, it would slow it down considerably. So they came up with this, as you say, it's much more like an Avid where instead of having one project, one file that represents your entire movie, now you can say, oh, I want this bin or this reel or whatever to be in its own project so that it keeps the file size down and keeps the ability for the computer to work a little better.
Yeah, no, I didn't use that on this project, but it does sound interesting.
So the whole movie was in one Premiere project?
Yes, the whole movie was often in one sequence within one Premiere project. And then there were a lot of different permutations of that sequence. And there were a lot of subsequences where we would rough things together or experiments, but ultimately we were iterating from a root sequence.
And you edited, the director didn't know how to edit with Premiere and get his hands dirty. You did all of it.
I think maybe the director had some editing experience. I think he maybe used to do like odd jobs on a reality show, he was telling me years ago. But no, he never drove. He never handled the computer, the edit on this movie at all.
Did you guys have a remote workflow? Did you have to work remotely because of COVID or anything else?
We never did, except that I went to Norway at one point during the production. During that time, I just did a cut of the movie while I was in Norway. And it wasn't really so much a remote workflow as just me working alone and then exporting a cut to send to the director and the producers.
Totally get it. Were there any things with structure, either moving things or removing scenes that you had to do? And why did that happen?
It's fascinating. And I've found that often in the process of an edit, a movie will explode and then you'll take the shards and craft something out of it. But that didn't really happen on this movie. There were a few scenes that were cut out because they felt extraneous or like they weren't helping the momentum of the movie, which moves pretty fast. The movie's pretty consistent. It's got a pretty intense pace. So I think in the first act of the movie, maybe the first 15 minutes, we scrambled some scenes around, I think. The first time that you see Emily's apartment and her living situation, and the script came a little later. It came maybe 10 minutes later. I think after a test screening or two, we felt some tension from the audience about that, that maybe people were craving an earlier understanding of just what her living situation was. So we found a way to just thread that scene a little earlier, and it ended up being really fluid. It doesn't seem like that's bumpy at all.
No, I didn't notice that was different. I loved it. There's a great montage that I loved with the credit card scene and the food prep. Talk to me about that. And how you decided to build that? Was it written that way?
I think in the script, I can't remember if it was denoted in the script that there would be intercut or that music would just be carrying over them. We definitely discovered a lot of that intercut language just through experimentation in the edit. The toughest thing about that sequence in the movie was just finding the right music. We tried a lot of different possibilities and a lot of them were totally dead wrong. There was this sense that we wanted the music to feel like it continued to carry the momentum of the film, but also that it felt like it was coming out of the character's subjectivity instead of being applied over top of the character, which is an idea that we kind of referred to a lot throughout the process about the way that we thought about music. So finally, over the course of iterating various songs and retrofitting each possibility to different rhythms, because that section of the movie is rhythmically oriented around the music, we somehow landed on the song that we did. But I think there was a lot of really granular work to make the flow of that intercut montage sequence feel the way that it does. And I know the director, John, kept on repeating the phrase that he wanted to make a movie that watches itself, which we kind of interpreted to mean a movie that has a deliciousness or something, like a sense that what's unfolding is flowing naturally, that it's effortless to watch. And so I think that montage, we tried to use some kind of tricky or like slick editing techniques, like really juicing sound effects, using sound effects timed with a song to sort of bridge between different scenes that were being intercut, like a door that closes and makes a sound that coincides with the opening of a trunk or that coincides with a box being ripped open. All that stuff had to be timed, and those timings had to change when we would try different songs that were possibilities.
But the song that you chose, if I'm understanding it, it almost felt like it needed to be coming off of her iPod, right? From her phone. Like this would be something for Emily's Spotify list, right?
Right. I mean, it's a little tricky. And I think there's even portions of that montage where the song is a little futzed to feel like it's diegetic instead of non-diegetic. Mm. I think the song that we landed on felt a little bit repetitive. So I think part of our tactic for trying to reduce the sensation of repetitiveness was to create those diegetic futzes in places.
Very interesting. I love that. Emily goes to meet her boyfriend's mother, and the three of them sit around a table drinking. This is a scene that happens in a lot of movies where multiple characters sit around a table, and they're hard to edit sometimes. Can you talk to me about cutting that table scene?
Sure. I think you're right that they're hard to edit, and I don't know whether I had any particular tricks of the trade to make it the way that it is. I think that, in general, there's a Walter Murch sensibility to the movie where we're trying to make the editing feel a bit invisible and the flow of the movie feel effortless so that you're not so much thinking about the cuts, but just in the story. And there was a lot of coverage in the scene. So each actor around the table had various singles or various over-the-shoulder shots in relation to everyone else at the table. So it felt like you could do anything, which, like I said before, could be a blessing or a curse. In this case, I tried to be really aware of eye lines and think about when we're focused on an actor and the actor is shifting their attention to someone else, to kind of use a merchy rhythm to cut with their attention to whatever they're focusing on, and then let those dictate the rhythm and the choices for who we're seeing and when. Largely, that became then about just finding the right portions of takes to use. I think in looking through the footage to find which portions of takes to use, I feel like I was just drawn to moments that felt alive and honest and didn't feel like acting. And I think in the process of establishing this quiver of moments like that and threading them together using the aforementioned philosophy, we arrived at what felt pretty streamlined from the first assembly. And the version of that scene that ended up in the movie is almost, I think, 80% the same as the first assembly.
Wow. You mentioned that there were multiple singles for each actor in that. And some people haven't dealt with a pretty experienced production crew might not realize is that on those table scenes, they usually have different angles for different eye lines. You've got an angle on the actor for when they speak to one person, and you've got a totally different angle on the actor for when they speak to someone else. Is that what was happening and you were trying to choose between those eye lines?
Totally, yeah, that's totally what was happening. So it's like sometimes we were trying to maybe isolate this sense of romance between Aubrey's character and Theo's character. So it's like maybe we're on that axis, but then sometimes the mother is interjecting and then we find ourselves on an axis between the mother and Emily. Yeah, all that stuff just has to play both intentional and effortless. And I feel like there aren't that many tricks that you can use there. You just have to brute force something that feels fluid and that feels correct.
I got to say that I think that the whole movie, the editing did seem very natural to me because I had very few notes to even talk about because I just got caught up in the story. And the next thing I know, I'm like, it's over. And I didn't make any notes except for the thing about the table and the montage.
My hypothesis for where that comes from is that as I get older and as I work on more projects, I feel increasingly skeptical or suspicious of my own intellect as the driving force in the creative or artistic choices that I make. So as an editor, especially, so much of the decision-making is visceral or is physical or it's rhythmic. And often when I'm editing, I'm like slamming the spacebar down on my computer. And, you know, if people are in the room with me, they're like making jokes about it. But often at the right frame to cut on, to me, feels like a physical sensation. It's like an itch to scratch or something. And so I think ultimately that kind of intuition is just personal. It's almost like you spend your life consuming various pieces of like art and media or reading books or working on stuff. You're developing your taste so that then when you're actually operating in the language, it's all just kind of your nature. It's like what's automatic kind of becomes what is most personal to you.
I wanted to unpack a little bit of that or talk about what you said about trying to get out of your intellectualness.
Right. I'm skeptical of my intellect as like a driving force or something.
I wanted to just talk about that because that's a really interesting thing. What would make you skeptical of your intellect when you're editing? What would make you go, oh, I think I'm being too intellectual about this?
I just think often if I make choices that come from my intellect, then they feel like intellectual choices in the movie. And the result of those choices is kind of the opposite of what the sensation that you just described, where it's like, if you're watching the movie and you're not aware of the editing, then it's a different sensation than watching a movie and feeling like each cut has like an intellectual or academic angle on it. If we're talking about sculpting a reality out of discrete pieces, which is essentially what editing is, I think a lot of the way that we process reality in real life, there's a more instinctual smell test, I think, than an intellectual process of constantly questioning whether something feels real. Something's either real or it isn't. It's not like you have to ask a lot of questions of your reality to know whether what you're experiencing is happening. I guess we're getting really philosophical now, but when it comes to trying to craft the fabric of reality, I just think that my gut knows the answers better than my brain does. And I think sometimes in the process of iteration, one's brain gets involved. I think in maybe troubleshooting structural problems with an edit, for example, or with the plot of a movie, in the case where you're working on a movie and it explodes and you have to refashion it, yes, your intellect is useful because you're thinking about discrete pieces of expositional information that maybe you need to include so the audience knows what's going on from one scene to the next. But when we're talking about cutting a dialogue scene between actors at a table or something, I just think that in real life, we're constantly editing our own experiences just based on what we're choosing to look at. And I think usually if you're walking around in your life, you're not really making conscious decisions about those choices. It's all stuff that's just happening. So I've come to just rely more on the animal part of me for trying to create something that feels quote unquote real, because I just think it's a better tool.
Absolutely. One final kind of geeky question for you, which is, how do you approach a blank timeline? We were just talking about crafting a conversation between two actors. You've got your dailies. They've been prepped by you or by an assistant. And then What do you do? Do you do string outs? How do you watch the dailies? And then how do you start a new scene?
I occasionally had string outs for some of the scenes in Emily the Criminal, which felt like such a luxury. I'd never worked with string outs before, and it was great. But usually I'll just watch all the footage, trying to tune in and note if anything catches my eye, sort of. If something feels particularly idiosyncratic or particularly alive or mysterious or chaotic, or like it maybe especially carries the energy of a particular moment in the script, then I'll note it and maybe I'll even cut it out of the footage and throw it in the timeline. So then usually over the course of that process, there arises a little set of selects from the scene, which I'll just start to kind of play with and experiment with. I think as I've edited more movies, I've become more adept at understanding like a temporal economy or something, or what pieces seem special but maybe actually aren't, or how to keep stuff really tight and fluid. And so a lot of that knowledge gets embedded into even my first assembly of a scene. Often the first assembly that I'll make of a movie or of a scene will feel pretty slick. And I think in my process, I'm a little bit detail oriented from the beginning. So if there's a certain ambient sound element in a scene, I'll need to incorporate that from the first assembly, basically, just to help me feel the scene myself. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm throwing a wall into a bar scene, or maybe it's a part of the movie that feels like it wants music. So I'm starting to like cut to a temp music or find a temp music that feels like it has the blood of the film that I can latch onto. I think often music can be really useful in helping to find a film's flow.
To follow up on that, you mentioned when you did that credit card catering montage that you put a bunch of different pieces of music afterwards. Did you cut the montage in the first place to music, or did you cut it without music?
I think in the very initial experimentation with that scene, the director had a reference point in mind that for a lot of the movie, which was this filmmaker, Jacques Audiard, who's a great French filmmaker. I think he has a montage in one of his films. I can't remember which one, but it's in a prison scene. We watched that montage and thought about it a bit, but I think in our initial experimentation with the movie, we were using music that ended up being totally wrong. It was a more alienated or somber tonal space. So I think maybe in the initial assembly of that montage, we might have been using a music like that. So then it's almost a car or something, and the music is a very important part. So when the music gets switched out, then suddenly all these other parts don't fit. And then it became this constant retrofitting, where it's like, oh, now this is so much more up-tempo, or this new music has so much more intensity, and the cuts are screaming at you where they want to be. We're just adjusting durations and occasionally changing the order of shots based on what each music attempt looks like.
I do want to cover one other thing now that I remember it from when we talked personally earlier. You mentioned the idea of delivering a cut to the director that you consider to be an audition, which I thought was brilliant. Can you talk to me about why you considered it an audition and what that means?
So I think that when I have been enlisted as the editor for a director's film, usually I know that the most useful compass that we have together in the trenches of the project is the director's deep vision for the film, their sense of what the film is. Often they know that better than anyone in the world. And so as the editor of a film, I want to get them closer to that. I don't want to apply my own thing over the film, because often the result of that is a disunity. So I feel like philosophically, my approach to working with the director then becomes, I come into the edit with my ideas, or I come into it to a scene or moment in the film with whatever set of ideas emerge from my intuition. And the process for deciding what's right then becomes auditioning different possibilities for the director, and then trying to maybe help the director tune into their own deeper sensibility, which we use as a compass to decide what's right. I guess that's where that idea of thinking of ideas in an edit as auditions for the director comes from. It's from thinking of myself as someone that's in between a director and their art project or something. So just trying to midwife a baby into existence, rather than trying to bring my own ego into crafting some kind of Frankenstein's monster.
Totally get it. I think it's just a really healthy way to look at it. I think a lot of editors, especially maybe young editors, take too much ownership of that cut and don't realize that it should be an audition, not here's the final look of what the scene is supposed to be, right?
Right. And I think sometimes it's natural to be attached to your own ideas sometimes, or to do something and think that it's such a precious, perfect baby. But I think ultimately there's a deeper truth that you can find by vibing into a filmmaker's vision if they have one. And I think that the films that are the most kind of sublime are the ones that feel like they're emerging from a rubric or a philosophy that isn't just like a set of academic boxes to check of is the sequel. It's more about a particularity of logic that can be really ineffable and that can just come from a person's artistic vision. And so if I'm midwifing someone's vision, then I want to know that the choices that I'm making are helping to facilitate the movie that is hidden within them.
Harrison, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed talking to you about this movie.
Thank you. It was fun. Appreciate you having me on.
That's it for this special Voices from Sundance episode of Art of the Cut. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to my guest, Harrison Atkins, for joining us on this Voices from Sundance episode of Art of the Cut. Thanks to Jake Gum for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.